language is difficult, maybe impossible to control, and it's tricky to predict how it will change. Are you a stickler on language? Seriously, do you use it properly? And by the way, what is proper? We're tackling these questions about language and grammar here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Lane Green is the language columnist and an editor at The Economist. His book is Talk on the Wild Side, Why Language Can't Be Tamed. We're reaching him from his home base in London, but he has family here in Wisconsin. Lane, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you for having me on.
Well, your book teaches us that language is alive and changing. You call it a wolf that is fit for its environment. But our language is messy and illogical and redundant. If it's so good at evolving, then what is broken about it?
Well, nothing's broken. I would say there are some things that aren't perfect. I think that when people think about language, they kind of want it to be a logical system with no ambiguity, no redundancy, nothing extra, nothing confusing. And the thing is that when things evolve kind of slightly chaotically in an ever-changing environment, like a living thing, like an organism, they're not going to turn out perfect logical systems. They're going to turn out robust and sometimes redundant systems that are able to take change and still be perfectly useful. Just like an animal over different eras will change its features. If it moves from one part of the ecosystem to another, it'll have to adapt or perish. And language does that amazingly all by itself. My book is all about the idea that it kind of looks after itself and it has all the features it needs without a whole lot of intervention by people.
Oh, so language doesn't really need us to mess with it. It can get along just fine. Thank you very much.
Well, that's the idea. You know, there are 7,000 languages in the world and we don't know of one that doesn't work. We don't know of one that's fallen apart. So that's the basic fact you have to start out with, is we don't know of any language ever that's kind of fallen to pieces because people fail to maintain it. It maintains itself, and that's the kind of amazing feature that it has. So when I say it's wild, I say that with admiration and not criticism at all. It's the other way around.
And we all take our different approach to the language and how we use it and where we use it. It's very versatile in that respect, is it not?
Well, absolutely. One of language's features one of the aspects of that versatility you mentioned is the ability to use different forms of language for different times. One thing I think people worry about is that if they don't keep their grammar sort of buttoned up perfectly at all times, then it'll sort of fall apart or we can't change it for changing circumstances. But there's a sort of joking line in my book that no one says whom in a biker bar. And, but if you write for The Economist in a place where whom is called for, you really need to use that proper whom. And so I'll edit a piece of prose that has a mistaken who whom, but I wouldn't say in a biker bar. And I, like most people, know the difference. And so people have a little mental switch or a little slider, really. They can dial up formality and very formal grammar as needed, or they can dial it down to a setting that is sometimes called normal rather than formal. And normal would be things like, can I get a coffee? And then formal would be, may I have a coffee? That kind of thing. There's distinctions like that all over the language. Nothing to be afraid of versus nothing of which to be afraid. One is normal, one is formal, and both are okay. Both are standard. They're just different.
You set out some definitions early on in your book, the difference between descriptivism and prescriptivism. Can you tell us about the difference and why it's a big deal in the world of linguistics?
Sure. One thing that it's important to remember about both sort of schools of thought is that they both want to come up with rules. But what the descriptivists do is they look at language in practice. They see what actual native speakers do, and they sort of derive the rules from what they see. So if they see educated, intelligent, articulate English speakers for 700-800 years splitting infinitives, then they'll say, as a descriptive fact, the split infinitive is part of the English language, part of its grammar. It's okay. If good speakers are doing it constantly, there can't be a fault with that. A sort of most sticklerish prescriptivist will derive the rules, I don't know from where else. They sometimes derive them from what they see as pure logic, or they sometimes just pass on rules that they've heard someone else tell them, and they'll say things like, well, an infinitive is a single unit and therefore cannot be split. And they seek to sort of impose the rule from on top, and they ignore the facts of English usage, the fact that great writers have been splitting infinitives since, the 1300s, since Middle English. And so The split infinitive is a good example of where prescriptivism and descriptivism will often get you to different rules, but they're both concerned with rules. Prescriptivism sort of imposes them, and descriptivism discovers them, if you like. But that doesn't mean anything goes. I don't want to give you the idea that descriptivists are just kind of long-haired hippies that say, no matter what you say, it's okay with me, man. That's not the case at all.
Well, prescriptivists sound a little bit more unyielding, unbending. They like the clear definitions, the clear boundaries of language. But it sounds as if you're saying language is more fluid than that, and the boundaries, you can kind of push them in different directions.
Sure, the boundaries can be pushed in a couple of ways. One is that sort of normal formal distinction I described earlier, where you can say something like, you know, nothing of which to be afraid in very formal English. You can say nothing to be afraid of in normal English. And you might say, you know, in very dialectal English, like the South where I come from, you can say there ain't nothing to be afraid of. You know, ain't is not standard in standard English, but it is okay. It's part of loads of dialects all over England, all over the United States. And so it fits in its niche, but it doesn't need to be part of every register of language. And so that idea of variation, the idea that something's okay over here but not over there, it's okay in this occasion but not in that occasion, I think that's where prescriptivism is too tight-laced. And if you give yourself a little bit of flexibility, I like to think of it as additive. You have more tools in your toolbox. You have a formal version for formal writing and giving a formal speech. You have a normal version for conversation. And you might have a home dialect, too. If you're African American, if you're a Southern white speaker like my dad, if you are a Scots English speaker somewhere in rural Scotland, all of those have their place, too. The tightest laced prescriptivist tradition is that only formal is okay. And that's what I'm pushing back on.
We're talking to Lane Green about his new book, Talk on the Wild Side, Why Language Can't Be Tamed. Do you know languages other than English? What are the most important differences, in your opinion? What are your biggest grammar pet peeves? And why do those in particular rise to the top? 800-642-1234. You can join the conversation or email ideas at WPR.org. Lane, on this conversation here about dialect, and we look at the southern United States, a lot of it, I seem to think, has to do with how we pronounce words. What makes it a dialect and not just perhaps a pronunciation of y'all?
That's a great question. Language, you can think of languages as existing on a kind of rough three levels. And I would say the level of pronunciation, the level of words, individuals, and then the level of grammar, how words go together to make sentences. And a dialect will differ on all three of those levels. So in the South, we'll have, you know, you'll say ride instead of ride. Mm-hmm. That's called glide deletion. Anyway, there are a lot of different pronunciations in the South. You might say pin and pin are homonyms. One of them spelled P-E-N and one of them spelled P-I-N. In Wisconsin, you'd probably say pin and pen, right? Uh-huh. So those are pronunciation differences. At the word level, of course, you have lots of dialectal words in the South. You'll say something like, a poke for a bag is an old word, or, you know, there's an old word, goobers, for peanuts. It comes from West Africa and came with slavery to the South. There's lots of other modern Southernisms that are different from the North. And then there are those grammar differences. And y'all is a good example. There's no clear second person plural pronoun in most of the United States, but the South has y'all for you all. And we have a few of those others for example, in New York English. You might say yous. In Pittsburgh and around there, you might say yins, but most of America doesn't have that. So that's where the grammar actually differs in having a whole new pronoun. And you do things like you might have double negation, like I ain't got nobody or something like that. So there's another grammar difference.
Lane Green stays with us as we explore the untamed and unruly nature of human language this hour. You can be a part of this language mayhem. 800-642-1234. Do you think getting grammar right is important, or do you think it doesn't really matter since we can't stop language from changing? 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll get back to the conversation in a moment on the Ideas Network. In his years of editing, Lane Green says he's never yet seen a piece of writing that could not be improved. Most pieces, he says, need at least something of a firm hand in getting them into shape, and many of them need a radical rewrite. We're looking at the grammatical standards we set in language and why we fall short in following unbendable rules in language. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The book is Talk on the Wild Side, Why Language Can't Be Tamed. Author and editor at The Economist, Lane Green, is with us. Bring on your insights regarding grammar and language. What have you observed? 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. So let's go to Tim now, joining us from Eau Claire with a question. Hi, Tim. Go ahead.
Hello. Conversation around our dinner table last night was about connotation versus denotation. Specifically, one word that was brought up was moist, which has a very specific dictionary definition, but evokes a different emotion in other people. I'm wondering if the guests may have some other really good connotation versus denotation. Sorry to put you on the spot. and maybe explain the difference to the listeners.
Thanks, Tim. Appreciate it. Go ahead.
That's a great question. Moist is kind of a famous example of what some linguists call word aversion, and it's exactly that. There's the dictionary definition, but I think what a word does in our mind is it lives in connection with other words. And so you can think of other things that might be described as moist, and many of those things might be kind of disgusting. You might have a moist kind of mold or damp in your basement, for example. And many of the, when something's sort of unexpectedly moist, we were sort of often disgusted by whatever that thing is. And so it goes into the associations we have with that word. There are lots of words like that. Skinny and thin mean basically the same thing, but they have very different connotations. If you call someone skinny, you're saying basically they're too thin. If you're saying thin, then usually you're paying them something like a compliment. So there are a lot of different words like that that have very different connotations, and they change over time. Words like prestigious used to be used negatively because they were sort of prestigious used to have something of a connotation of show-offy, and now it doesn't have that anymore. The word fulsome confuses people because some people use it to mean very very elaborate praise, and some people use it to mean over elaborate, fake, too elaborate praise. And so connotation can be quite confusing to a lot of people because, either geographically or just kind of randomly among the speakers, some people will have part of the connotation or one connotation, and some will have others. And moist is a great example. There's a lot of people that hate that word.
You also talk in your book about the word awesome and how awesome has evolved.
Yeah, awesome is a kind of famous hallmark of young, now becoming middle-aged American English. Awesome was big when I was young, and I'm now in my 40s. I don't mind telling Wisconsin and the world. And awesome used to be a very powerful word. It really meant awe-inspiring, hugely powerful. Actually, its first meaning wasn't that. It was actually awe-filled. It was the person who was awesome. They were filled with awe when they beheld something. And then it switched over to the thing itself and became something like awe-inspiring. Then it became something like really, really good. Then it became something like really good. And then it became just good. And then it became just kind of everything is awesome, as the song in the Lego movie goes. And you can even just use it as a random I've heard you. Hey, man, I'm going to go to the store. Okay, awesome. So you could – it's almost bleached of all meaning through use. So certainly you can inflate, just like a currency. You print too much of it and it doesn't become worth it, worth anything anymore. It becomes worthless. Awesome is going through a bit of that. In other words, go that same route. It's hardly, hardly the only word that's gone that way.
So, Lane Green, you're an editor. What role do editors have in all of this? Because are you really limited by the madness of language, like trying to tame it, and you're trying to create order in this chaos as an editor?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, you'll never make anything perfect. Language, as I say in the book, is an animal behavior because we are Homo sapiens is an animal, right? And it's one of our core behaviors. So it's never going to be just perfect. But what the editor can do is the editor is kind of a first stand-in for the reader. So the writer writes something out of their expertise. The writer might be an expert in artificial intelligence, say. And there's a lot of concepts in AI that are complicated for the person who's reading their first article about it or isn't a specialist. So the editor is to be the first reader and say, you've made a leap of logic that is clear to you, but it's not clear to the reader. We need to fill that out. You've used a word that nobody in the audience is going to know. We need to give a plain English definition or use a plain English synonym. Your sentences have got quite long, And it's hard for a reader to process long sentences. Let's chop a couple of these up. That's one of the best things a writer and an editor can do, is chop up long sentences. You've used a lot of abstract words. I want some more concrete examples, something that the reader can picture in their mind's eye, things like that. Mm. Editors do that stuff to be the first reader and make it easier for the broad readership once the thing hits print.
Well, you said the word long sentences, and immediately my mind goes to legal writing, to legalese. Is that proper? And where do we get this legal writing? And when we read it, it seems so convoluted, but to some people, it is crystal clear.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of things going on with legalese. Some of them are more harmless or beneficial even, and some of them are useless and really could be gotten rid of. On the good side, legal writing, when good, is very, very precise, because words have to have a clear definition. You know, the elements of a contract, when a contract is considered operative and fulfilled, you know, words have to be defined. If you signed a lease recently, it'll say, you know, define the leasee and the letter and so forth in the contract in very clear terms. That way, everybody knows what the contract means. So that over precision, we can allow a little bit of kind of room to play with for style in ordinary writing, but legal language has to be very precise. But lawyers do a few unnecessary things. There's a lot of stuff that's just inherited, like the words to aid and abet don't both need to be there. There's a lot of stuff that's just been said forever and ever. And, you know, there's a lot of these little doublets in English. They're called aid and abet, have and hold, and things like that, where you really don't need to say it twice. But it's been a sort of fossilized part of the language for a long time. And so lawyers learn from people who have been lawyers before them. And so they get this kind of fossilized wordiness passed down to them. And that's one of those things that can be gotten rid of. They're in love with the word shall, and there's a good legal lexicographer called Brian Garner who sort of waged a campaign against using shall, because shall can mean a bunch of different things. It can order someone to do something. It can just make a simple statement of what's going to happen in the future. It can mean a sort of 8, 9, 10 different things, and there's a section on that in my book explaining why shall is confusing, but lawyers think it sort of seems proper. It sort of seems buttoned up in proper formal legal English, and so it's actually worse than a lot of its alternatives, but it looks fancy, and so lawyers are tempted to use it. So those are just a few of the problems with legalese, in my opinion.
We're talking to Lane Green about his book, Talk on the Wild Side, Why Language Can't Be Tamed. Do you feel strongly that there's a right way and a wrong way to speak? And what makes you so firm on that? 800-642-1234. You can join the conversation by email at ideas@wpr.org. Lane, let's look at this language, Esperanto, invented as a way for the whole world to speak and communicate to one another, as like this second fallback language. And I think I read some estimates there are about 2 million people who speak it. How was it invented and what is its use?
So there was a guy called Ludwig Zamenhof, and he was about 100 years ago working to fight what he considered a sort of scourge of nationalism. Europe was kind of dividing itself up into linguistically homogeneous nation states, and Bulgarians would all go into a country called Bulgaria, and Czechs would all go into a country called Czechoslovakia, and things like that. This is the sort of a big second wave of European nationalism. And he said this is going to cause lots of wars. There were wars going on at the time over the borders of Europe. And so he said if everyone uses a second language, a sort of neutral language that's nobody's first language, and if that language is super easy to learn, this will be conducive to world peace. A, people will understand each other, and B, they won't be leaning on one big, powerful, prestigious language like French or English or German at that time. And so he invented an easy-to-learn language with no irregularity. All the rules can be learned in about 15 minutes. I mean, seriously, he made the grammar as simple as he could make it, and borrowed lots of roots from the main European languages, some from Germanic languages, some from Slavic, some from Romance. But if you know anything about these languages, you can pick up the vocabulary quite quickly. But the thing is, it's been about 120 years, and the language just has not taken the world by storm. It's always had a passionate user base. Don't make fun of the Esperantists. They're good people. They're often, you know, very idealistic. They have conferences, and they have a meetup, and they find each other all over the world and make friends. And there's something like a global Esperanto community. But as you mentioned, maybe 1 million or 2 million sort of speakers, and I'm making invisible air quotes because a lot of people have sort of studied it as a hobby, but the number of fluent speakers is far smaller than that. And so I take it that people don't want, you know, Esperanto. If they did, it probably would have succeeded by now. It's not for lack of awareness that it exists. But we used to have French as kind of the major world diplomatic language. And now, frankly, that language is English. It's sort of a neutral language among a lot of people. If you have a Swedish person in Brazil, that person's going to speak English. And that's the second language that a lot of people fall back on now.
The book is Talk on the Wild Side. Author Lane Green is with us. Do you diagram sentences? Do you remember that from elementary school on a blackboard in front of the class? I remember diagramming and how it was difficult to fit these diagrams on the chalkboard. But diagramming created that visual for what you were writing. And we're looking at the anatomy of sentences and the language here on The Morning Show. You can join in at 800-642-1234. When you think of grammar, what do you think about? Let's talk about it. We'll pick up the conversation after a news update here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Grammar gets a lot of play in Hollywood scripts. Have you noticed that? Perhaps because it's funny and we can relate. Here is a moment on The Big Bang Theory when Sheldon and Howard debate the appropriate tense to use when talking about something that happened in an alternate past timeline.
Whoa. Is placed right?
What do you mean?
Is place the right tense for something that would have happened in the future of a past that was affected by something from the future?
Had will have placed?
That's my boy.
It's possible that the script writers were having a real-life debate about tense in their script and realized how funny it is. The book is Talk on the Wild Side, and author Lane Green stays with us. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What rules of grammar confuse you? What do you really hold up in your own writing? And what do you want to ask our language expert this morning? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Lane, as we just heard in that clip, grammar can get really funny and just how we debate it as humans. What does that say about us?
Well, we're playful animals by nature. We're social creatures. We don't know exactly how language evolved. There's lots of theories, and we don't know exactly which one of them nails it. But, you know, clearly part of human evolution was the sort of transferring contents of one mind into another, you know, the fact that we can cooperate. Other animals can, for example, use tools, but they don't come together to use the tools in the same way that humans do. Even animals with very sophisticated social lives. So we use language to get thoughts from my head to yours. But part of that social life is kind of the unexpected. Humor, you know, trades on the unexpected, and so weird quirks of grammar where they don't belong are funny. I give an example in the book of the show The Last Man on Earth when the last man on Earth, the entitled character, meets what it turns out he thinks at the time to be the last woman on Earth. They're two survivors of a virus that's wiped out humanity. And he says, there's nothing to be afraid of. And she says, there's nothing of which to be afraid. And you're thinking, what? Why is he correcting his grammar?
At this moment, you just
met the last man on Earth, and the future of the human species might be in your hands. This is not the time, Carol. And so that's what makes the humor in that situation. And I go into that scene a little bit more in the book.
You speak a lot of languages: Arabic, French, German, Italian, Portuguese, Spanish, English, of course. As you look at this rainbow of languages, are there some things that we have in common across languages, some messiness, or are languages quite different in their terms of rules and vocabulary?
Well, They all share the feature of having messiness. There's never a language, except for Esperanto. There are not any widely spoken languages. There are no natural languages, let me say that. There are no languages that were sort of evolved rather than created that don't have messiness. And every one of those languages you just mentioned and every other one out there has rules where when you're learning them as a student, you're like, what? Why is that there? I mean, in Arabic, a number has the opposite gender of the thing it modifies. You so if you say three cars and cars are feminine, you make the three masculine. It's crazy. There's stuff like that all over every language, and stuff that just makes you want to tear your hair out. So they do share that. They do share features too, but it's a little harder to describe the commonalities because there are about 7,000 languages in the world, and nobody's done a full study of all of them. So it's a little hard to draw out what we know ties all the languages of the world together. That's something that linguists are still working on.
Sometimes when you talk with someone who is bilingual or trilingual, they just say, well, you know, in these other languages, they have just better ways to describe something, better words than we have in English. And they sometimes start to look down on English in a way. And for someone who is not fully bilingual, I look at them kind of with this peculiar, but I'm like, but it's English. I mean, aren't we the best?
Yeah, I think everybody, one of the things that's kind of common to all people is a sort of myth making about their own language, that our language is certainly weird and difficult for outsiders to learn, but it's also expressive, or it's people, some people think their language is the most logical, or other people think their language is the most poetic. You hear a lot of things like this. It's really hard to prove them. My first book is called You Are What You Speak, and it's all about this question of sort of language and identity. But it's certainly, it's almost a kind of human universal. People talk about their own languages in kind of unique terms because they think that their culture is unique, which it is. All the languages of the world truly are different, but there are lots of them competing for the title of most illogical or most logical or funniest or most expressive. You hear this kind of thing all the time. My Arabic teacher told me recently that Arabic has a million words and English has only several hundred thousand, and that's why Arabic was richer than English. And I said, okay. I didn't want to push back. He's a very nice man. But but you hear that kind of thing a lot. It can be very hard to prove.
How do you keep up all those languages? You have to practice a lot.
Yeah, they do need maintenance. You know, I like to say it's a little bit like keeping up other skills, playing the piano or, you know, something like that. It's not like riding a bike where you can hop on a bike after 20 years and maybe a wobble or two later, you're kind of going in a straight line, because there's a lot more to it than that. And so if you neglect one for a really long time, like I haven't spoken my Russian in a good 20 years, it does get rusty. I'd have a tough time having a good conversation in Russian right now. But if you gave me 3 weeks to work on it, I'd probably be pretty good. So they get rusty if you neglect them long enough. That's absolutely the case.
We're talking with Lane Green about his book, Talk on the Wild Side, Why Language Can't Be Tamed. And you can join in, 800-642-1234. Do you think getting grammar right is important? What questions do you have about grammar and vocabulary? How do you want to stump Lane? 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. Lane, speaking of Twitter, social media, you know, young people are using their devices all the time, texting, Snapchat. How is language evolving through social media?
I get that question a lot. It's a good question because people are very concerned about it. And I think that what we're the answer is kind of boring. It's less than you think. The standard English that's written in the newspaper or in The Economist or, you know, in any kind of serious publication is really lightly affected by social media. After well over 10 years of Facebook and Twitter really taking over the world, we just see a few words. We see hashtags. People, you know, write the hashtag #MeToo. That's a good example of something that Twitter has given language. But it's hardly a radical rewrite of the language. And I think what confuses people a little bit is that the style of language being used on social media can sometimes be different from the formal English we're used to reading in the newspaper. People might not punctuate or capitalize in their text messages or on Facebook. And, you know, that's their right if they don't want to. But what we're seeing is the development of a new kind of language. It kind of sits on a borderline between writing and speech, because it is written, but it's written in such a style that's almost like speech. And so a friend of mine, John McWhorter, a linguist at Columbia, calls it fingered speech, because it's a kind of – it's both written and spoken. And so that's a new thing happening, but it's not affecting the way people speak very much, and even less affecting how people write in other places, like the paper, as I say, or if you're writing a student essay. Students know not to write hashtags in their student essays. They're clever in that.
Well, maybe character limits are actually a good thing for us, that we have to be more efficient with what we're saying.
You know, I absolutely, I think I agree. In The Economist, we often have very complicated pieces that are sort of 550 words long, which is very short, or 600 or 1,000. But we really stress getting as much into that space as possible. So cutting out the words that don't need to be there is one of the best things you can do for your writing. And if you edit, like I do every day, you realize how much really can go. And if you edit for print, you have a hard maximum. And if you write for Twitter, you have a hard maximum, that 280 characters. So that discipline can be a real tonic for your writing. If you just somebody said, you know, go through everything you write and strike out every 10th word. I wouldn't say do it that robotically, but if you try to cut your word count by 10%, if you get 1,000 words and then say by hook or by crook I'm going to get this down to 900, I guarantee you that piece will be better.
So France has this very prestigious organization called the French Academy that's over 400 years old, and its purpose is to keep the French language pure, free of the influences from English and other languages. What about this academy is trying to tame language, and is it working? And why put such a buffer around your language?
Well, the French decided to do this about 400 years ago. So this is the mid-1600s we're talking about. And the Academy's been at it for a long time. And their remit is officially to kind of keep the purity and expressiveness of the French language. But the fact is that French has continued to change over that entire time. In other words, has the Academy sort of worked? Well, no. French is not like it was in 1650. And it shouldn't be. Languages don't sit still, no matter how prestigious the Academy. If you ask French intellectuals, is it a good thing that we sort of protect the French language? They'll say, absolutely, absolutely, of course. But the language keeps changing anyway. French is full of English borrowings like Le Weekend and the hot dog and so forth, Le Marketing or whatever. And the language itself changes, you know. If you know any French, you negate things twice. You put a ne before the verb and a pas after the verb. But a lot of people are now just leaving out the ne. They say, je sais pas, I don't know, instead of je ne sais pas. That's a major grammatical change. It's been going on for a long time in speech. The Academy's conservatism kind of makes people not do that in writing, but they will do it in speech because it's very, very hard to stop spoken language changing.
Well, we don't have an equivalent academy for English, do we?
No, we sure don't. And yet, you know, English is taking over the world. So if you think you need a pure, guarded language in order to have a good language, you're absolutely wrong. The language that is conquering the world right now is one that is left completely to its own devices. There's no English Academy anywhere in Britain or in America. There have been proposals for one. Jonathan Swift in 1712 wanted an Academy for English because even 300 years ago, people thought the language was falling to pieces. Jonathan Swift was no different than so many other writers who have said English is going to the dogs. But we've done speak on behalf of the English language community of the world. We've done well. The world is saturated by English now, despite the total lack of a guardian to keep it perfect and pure and expressive. That's a good thing, in my opinion.
Here's some inspiration from Lane Green's book, Talk on the Wild Side. Words change meaning. New ones are born and other ones die. There is change in the system, but it functions as a system, not as a lot of randomly fluctuating pieces. We're probing this system of grammar and language, gathering your thoughts along the way at 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As we have this conversation about the changing nature of grammar and language and how we get so caught up in the finer details, it's fun to play our favorite clips from shows. And here is an episode from The Office where we get this brilliant exchange that touches on all of the problems with who whom.
It's whoever, not whomever.
No, it's whomever.
No, whomever is never actually right.
Well, sometimes it's right.
Michael is right. It's a made-up word used to trick students.
No, actually, whomever is the formal version of the word.
Obviously, it's a real word, but I don't know when to use it correctly.
It's whom when it's the object of the sentence and who when is the subject.
That sounds right.
Well, it sounds right, but is it?
And this pronoun scene ends with Michael telling Toby to stick a letter opener in his skull. The drama of grammar. The book is Talk on the Wild Side, Why Language Can't Be Tamed, and Lane Green is our guide. And you have a line to him, 800-642-1234. Let's lead off with Josh joining us from somewhere in Minnesota. Hi, Josh.
Hi. My name is Josh. I'm from La Crescent, Minnesota, and I'm an English teacher. I have two questions. One refers to the pronoun who versus that in terms of personal versus impersonal pronoun usage. I have an old grammar book that suggests that it's accurate to use that as a personal pronoun, and I've always found that problematic. My second question is something to which the speaker referred earlier, and that is the usage of a preposition at the end of a sentence. I was just curious as to his opinion regarding both of those issues. Thank you.
Thank you, Josh. Great questions. Let's hear it, Lane.
Okay, so who for a human or living subject is correct and formal, but is that informal or is it incorrect? And can you use other forms as well? Here's a quick example. The Lord's Prayer in the King James Bible is Our Father, which art in heaven, which, right? He says, Our Father, not who art in heaven, but which art in heaven. So using which or that for a human goes back a very, very long time, and it's in the very highest registers of English in different points in English history. And today, in writing and in formal circumstances, who is a little bit more correct in, or a little bit more appropriate for formal use, but that is a very, very, very common alternative. I wouldn't classify it as wrong. I'd classify it as informal. If I were a teacher like you, I'd say go with who in writing. But as a teacher, I'd say, look, that form exists. I just don't want you to use it in papers. I know that people think that students need a really clear black and white rule, but very often the answer is not black and white. It's a distinction between normal and formal. And that goes to the preposition at the end of the sentence. The preposition at the end of the sentence thing is one of the greatest myths of English grammar out there, bar none. It's just, it was stated as a preference in the 1700s by John Dryden, the poet and the essayist. He said that it's really better style to say things like nothing of which to be afraid rather than nothing to be afraid of, because that's how Latin works. But that's not how English works. English has had prepositions at the end of clauses forever and ever and ever, which is why everybody does it in speech and almost everybody does it in writing. Dryden's preference, and again, this was just a style preference, about 100 years later made it into one of the first influential grammar books. And from there, it got repeated in other grammar books. And before you knew it, people were learning this as a rule. It's never been a rule. I think you can, if anyone tells you you can't end a sentence in a preposition, you can stop taking grammar advice from that person right away. I mentioned that scene from the show with The Last Man on Earth, because it is not a rule of English. It has never been a rule of English. It is a bit of formal style. That's all it is.
Josh, thanks for the call. Let's go to Chris now, joining us from Evansville. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. I'm very excited to hear about your book. I have a question about American Sign Language. I've been an interpreter with American Sign Language for quite a while within the deaf community. And it's a very rich language, and a lot of the grammar of American Sign Language is shown on the face, especially with facial expressions related to eyebrows and mouth positions, and a lot of spatial movement to show directionality for prepositions. So it's a very interesting language. When I compare it to a couple other languages, English and Spanish, there are some phrases, for instance, we say in English, oh, you missed the boat. In Spanish, they say, se fue el avión, which is loosely, the airplane has gone. And in American Sign Language, a sort of loosely translated gloss is train gone, sorry. So there's three vehicles, a train, a boat, and a plane, and those kind of comparisons are very interesting to me. So I just wondered if you've done any study on American Sign Language.
Yeah, no, I'm not a great expert in sign language, I have to admit. There's quite a few different sign languages, and there's a lot of things to be learned about how they use, as you mentioned, a lot of different features. In speaking, I'll give you a comparison, though, because I know a bit more about speech. There are a lot of elements of the speech signal you can control, basically how rounded your lips are, how high your tongue is, how forward or back your tongue is, whether air comes out of your nose or not, whether you articulate a consonant at the teeth, just behind the teeth, on the soft palate, blah, blah, blah. There's lots and lots of these. And so all of the interplay of all of them gives us all of the sounds we need to make words in English. And so it makes perfect sense that American Sign would have to, or any sign language, would have to take advantage not just of the hands, but of the eyebrows and the other things that you mentioned, because we have a lot of articulators in the mouth we can control for speech. And so a sign language, to be rich, and they all are very, very rich and expressive, would need to make as much use of as many parts of the hands, face, and so forth as possible.
I love, Chris, making the comparison between English and Spanish and sign language, and everyone's kind of moving in the same direction, but taking a little bit of a different path to get there, a different variation.
That's right. I mean, what you see in language is the huge diversity. And it's one of the great things about studying foreign languages, because if you're tempted to say things like, oh, a double negative means a positive, I don't see nobody means I do see someone. Well, there are loads of languages, and Spanish is one of them, and Russian is one of them, that require double negation. Yo no veo a nadie. You say, I do not see nobody, literally, in Spanish. And what those two negatives do is kind of reinforce each other. So, you know, it's a little bit like getting there two different ways. People think that I don't see nobody, you know, they sort of multiply. And if you multiply two negatives, you get a positive in math. But in Spanish, they add. You get a negative plus a negative is a stronger negative. So there's a sort of different math metaphor going on in the two languages, if you like.
We had a caller who couldn't stay with us, but he really doesn't appreciate these sort of tics in our speech when people say, you know, and like, and they really pepper it into their speech. What is going on there?
There's a whole great book called about disfluencies by a writer named Michael Erard, who's very, very good. So I can recommend that book if you want a book-length treatment. But most people are not such skilled speakers that they never have to pause, restart a sentence, rethink what they were going to say. We all make speech errors all the time. And you and I do a lot of public speaking, and you're a radio presenter. Even we will have to occasionally, you know, pause for a you know.
Yes.
And that's very, very normal. The idea that everyone should be perfectly fluent 100% of the time, it would be great if it were the case. I just said right there because I needed an extra half second to process that next thing I was going to say. And this is just, it is perfectly normal. In fact, there's even a book that claims that or something like including is in every language in the world. They found some kind of filled pause that sounds a little bit like it's one of the very kind of basic vowels. And we all need some time to plan because language is a very complicated mental performance. And so you do need time. Either that or you have to speak agonizingly slowly, and nobody likes that either, do we?
Well, Lane Green, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a blast.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you for having me on.
Lane Green is the language columnist and an editor at The Economist. His new book out is called Talk on the Wild Side, Why Language Can't Be Tamed. And you've been listening to this conversation about language and grammar and how we can control it. You hear it right here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for listening.